From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Singer-songwriter and guitarist Dave Alvin co-founded the roots rock band The Blasters and played with X. He not only writes good songs, he writes good poems. On today's Fresh Air, we'll talk about his writing, and he'll read his poem After We Had Sex. Also today, Poetry Slams. We talk with Bob Holman and Bill Adler about their new CD, an anthology. It's a companion to the PBS series, The United States of Poetry. And we'll talk with Gregory Vistica, the reporter who broke the Tailhook story. He's written a new book about Tailhook and other scandals in the Navy. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Dave Alvin is best known as a blues-influenced singer-songwriter and guitarist. He has several albums under his own name. He co-founded the roots rock band The Blasters with his brother Phil Alvin, and he recorded with and wrote songs for the group X. Dave Alvin is also a poet, a good one. We invited him to read from and talk about his new collection of poems, Any Rough Times Are Now Behind You. The last time he joined us, back in the summer of 1994, he performed some of his songs. Let's start things off with an excerpt from that performance to give you a sense of his music. Here he is playing his song, Border Radio.
So one more midnight, and her man is still gone. The night moves too slow, and she tries to remember the heat of his touch while listening to the border radio. And this song comes from 1962, dedicated to a man who's gone. 50,000 watts out of Mexico, this is the border radio. This is the border radio.
Dave Alvin recruited in the Fresh Air studio in 1994. Okay, let's hear him read from his new book of poems, Any Rough Times Are Now Behind You. This poem is called After We Had Sex.
After we had sex, after she left Virginia for Los Angeles, after she moved in with me, after we lived together for 2 years, after she asked every day if I still loved her, after I told her I did, after her first serious anxiety attack, after she wouldn't get a job, after I quit 2 bands, after I went into debt to keep my own band on the road, after a 300-pound guy wearing a purple negligee jumped in my car while I was waiting for her to come out of a store, kidnapped me at gunpoint, saying, "Just drive and I won't kill you," after I said, "Please don't kill me," after he threw the gun down when we saw a cop, after he and I fought for control of the wheel, after the cop arrested him, after I testified against the 300-pound man and he was sentenced to prison for 2 years, after I went broke and sold off my rare guitars, after I broke up my band, after she had more serious anxiety attacks, after she started seeing a therapist, after we started fighting every day, after we lived in 3 apartments, after we spent 4 days not saying a word to each other, after we stopped having sex, after I cheated on her once, after we started seeing a couples counselor, after an old lover died of AIDS, after we took the AIDS test, after we tested negative, after I spent 2 months living in Nashville, after I was dropped from my record label, after I caught meningitis, after I spent 2.5 weeks in 2 different hospitals, after I didn't get paid for a tour I only did for the money, after her car was stolen, after she worked a succession of receptionist jobs, after she asked every day if I still loved her, after I lied to her every day, after she found a decent job downtown, after guys at her job started asking her out, after we decided there was no reason to stay together, after we looked for 3 months at apartments for her, after she finally found one she liked, after I paid her first and last month's rent plus the security deposit, after I moved her things into her new apartment, after I waited for the gas person, the phone person, the cable TV person, after I told her to call me if she ever needed anything, after she asked me if I still loved her, after I lied one last time, after I left her alone in her new apartment, after I ate dinner alone that night at a Chinese restaurant, After I opened my fortune cookie, my fortune read, "Any rough times are now behind you."
That's Dave Alvin reading from his new collection of poems, "Any Rough Times Are Now Behind You." Well, a real lucky in love poem, huh? Dave Alvin, our listeners who know your work know your music. When did you start writing poems?
I actually started writing poems in college, seriously. You know, I wrote when I was a kid, but I had some great teachers at the Long Beach State University Creative Writing Department, Gerald Lachlan, Elliot Freed, and Richard Lee. And it was before I ever wrote songs or anything. And because of their, especially Elliot Freed was very strict about training us to write sonnets and Alexandrines and blank verse, that when I started the Blasters with my brother and started writing songs, it was very easy to write songs. Poetry's a little more difficult, though, for me.
What do you think you're doing in poems that is different from what you're doing in lyrics?
Well, I can get a little more personal. It would be hard to write something like that and make it, I don't know, maybe you could make it a hit song these days. I don't know. But I think I can maybe be a little more, I don't know the word. I want to say real, but that's such a useless word. I can be even more honest, you know, in a poem.
The poem that you just read, I have to ask you if a couple of things really happened. Were you really kidnapped by a 300-pound man in a purple negligee?
Yeah.
What happened?
I was sitting in a car. It was a really hot day in Los Angeles, and the woman... my girlfriend at the time was inside a store, and there was no parking in front of the store, so I went around the corner, and like I said, it was about 90 degrees. I had the windows down, and next thing you know, I had a passenger.
and he got the wheel from you?
He told me to drive, and so I drove, and we were driving down the street, and we were passing the store where my girlfriend at the time was standing. And she's like looking at me like, "Oh, who's your friend?" And right at the same time, there was a policeman giving somebody a jaywalking ticket, and so my passenger and I had a little conversation about the policeman, and then it was one of those situations where I decided I'm going to try to steer the car into the policeman's motorcycle. That'll get his attention, and so we fought over the wheel at that point. And the rest is criminal history.
How did you get the officer's attention?
We drove the car into the motorcycle.
And he didn't sue you for that, I hope.
No.
And getting back to the poem again, how sick were you when you had the meningitis?
I was pretty sick.
How'd you get it?
Well, they came into the room one day in the hospital and they said, "We need to know every place you've been and everyone you've had contact with in any way for the past 2 weeks." And so they gave me a phone, and it became kind of like a Raymond Chandler thing, because I was touring at the time, so it was like calling various cities and, you know, informing the musicians that I was touring with and, you know, blah, 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 people I had met, people I talked to backstage. And we finally tracked it down to, there had been an outbreak of meningitis in Santa Cruz where I'd played, and there was one of those backstage scenes after the gig. And there was a woman back there, and it was like 2:30 in the morning, and this just doesn't make me sound good at all, but we were out of beer, okay? And it was 2:30 in the morning, and this woman that was visiting backstage, one of the other guys in the band, had like a half-full beer, and she wasn't drinking it. And I said, "Are you done with that beer?" And she said, "Yeah, you can have it." So I finished her beer, and the rest is medical history.
Wow.
And then what was really funny was I called her up, you know, and once we traced it, and I said, "Do you have these symptoms, you know, blah, 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 blah." And she goes, yeah, I feel horrible, I feel horrible. And I was like, "Yeah, well, look, I'm in the Oakland, you know, Kaiser Hospital in Oakland, California, and, you know, I've got meningitis, and you should probably go, you know, check into a hospital immediately." She goes, "No, I don't. I don't have meningitis. No, I don't. You know, you have all the symptoms. No, I'm not sick. I'm not sick. I never heard of you. Goodbye, you know." So hopefully she made it through. I don't know.
Well, that's the last time you'll share a beer. Huh?
That was the last time I shared a beer.
Yeah. So was there
something... That's like stupid ways to catch great diseases, you know.
What set off this poem? Was there a specific last straw that made you sit down and write it?
It is actually, all that stuff took place a while ago. And sometimes, for me anyway, I like to let things gestate. When I write about something when it's happening, it tends to be overly emotional or bad. And it's one of the reasons I don't make a lot of records, because I like to let what's going on in my life gestate. Is that the word?
Yeah.
And so it kind of sat around in me for about 4 years. And then one evening, I found the old fortune cookie that said, "Any rough times are now behind you." And I was trying to remember, where did I get this? Why did I have this? I was like, oh, yeah. You know, and when I had gotten the fortune cookie, when I got the fortune, I said, I'm going to keep this for the rest of my life now.
And, of course, was the prediction true? It's just been a happy ending ever since.
Oh, yeah. I've never been happier.
Now, did you read much poetry when you were young?
Yeah, not a lot. I did some. Where I went to school in Long Beach, there was a little poetry scene that Lachlan and Freed were kind of the patron saints of, or maybe Bukowski was the patron saint. But there was there was such a good writing department that a lot of writers went through there. I don't know if you're familiar with Bob Flanagan, the late Bob Flanagan, who passed away about a month ago. He and I were in school together. And so, yeah, there'd be readings at, you know, little bookshops and all that. And in those days, this was, you know, getting to be way back there. It was kind of fun. You know, you'd drink a beer and read a poem, and then your teacher would drink a beer with you and read his poems, and it was fun, you know.
Were the worlds of music and poetry usually two separate worlds for you?
Yeah. A lot of musicians don't understand poetry, and a lot of poets don't understand musicians. And they're pretty much the same thing. A lot of my songwriting influences have been more literary than songwriterly, you know. When I write lyrics for a song, I'm thinking as much about Raymond Chandler or Ernest Hemingway as I am thinking about Chuck Berry or Bob Dylan.
You know, it seems to me if you're reading poetry at a bar, let alone at a bookstore, that there's much less that separates you from the audience than at a club.
Yeah.
You know, first of all, you have all the equipments, you know, the instruments and everything separating you from the audience. And second of all, it's just a different atmosphere. You're much more accessible at a poetry reading.
Yeah, I actually don't like doing poetry readings. So
for that reason? Or?
Yeah, that and I liked them when I was young, when I was in college. They were fun because they were kind of a way of, you know, like screaming, you know, and getting a lot of those, you know, confused emotions you have at that age. It was a way of getting them out, and it was a way of, especially with the teachers I had, it was a way of feeling like that I came from someplace, that I was somebody. And I think that that's one of the great things that poetry can do for just, you know, everyone once they start writing it, is it helps you to define yourself. And but now it's gotten to a point where if I don't have a guitar on, it's not that I feel naked, it's just that I don't think I'm very good at it. You know, there are some people that, you know, Henry Rollins, for instance, is great at performing his work. And that's, you know, not something that I wouldn't put myself down the Dylan Thomas category of inspired readers, you know.
Singer, songwriter, and guitarist Dave Alvin is my guest. He has a new collection of poems called Any Rough Times Are Now Behind You. We'll take a short break and then talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Back with singer, songwriter, guitarist, and poet Dave Alvin. Did you, when you were in school, go through the lyrics as poetry scare? Were your teachers were hand out Xeroxes of Bob Dylan or Simon and Garfunkel?
Yeah, they do that. Except because I went to a Catholic school, they would always be, they wanted to interpret all the lyrics to rock and roll songs in a religious context.
Oh, that's great.
So the teachers would bring in, the brothers would bring in Aqualung or a record like that and, you know, talk about, you know, Aqualung in relationship to Catholicism. And it would just be, you know, and then the kids are all looking at each other because they're out, you know, smoking pot or something in the parking lot listening to it, and they're not thinking of anything like that.
There's another poem I want you to read for us.
Yeah.
This is a poem about Charles Bukowski.
Yeah.
But before you read it, tell us why you wrote it.
When he passed away, Linda Bukowski, his wife, asked me and about eight other writers to write sort of remembrances or tributes to him for a magazine, a poetry magazine out in L.A. called Caffeine. And so I was real honored that Linda thought of me for that. And that's another true story, and it does involve the same person from the other poem.
I'm glad you said that. I thought this was two really bad back-to-back relationships.
Oh, no. No, I think I can mine this one for another 10 years. Every time I get up, I think of something else that was horrible about it. And I should be fair and say that she's probably writing poems that are as accurate about me being as no good as mine are. You want to do it now?
Yeah, why don't you read it?
It's a poem for Charles Bukowski. I once lived with a woman who owned doubles of every F. Scott Fitzgerald book. If you really loved me, she'd say, you'd burn your Bukowski books. Already in the name of love, I'd quit smoking in the bedroom, stopped talking to most of my close friends, and thrown away a small collection of porno magazines and even an autographed copy of Bob Flanagan's S&M Love Sonnets. But the Bukowski books was where I drew the line. No, I'd tell her. And sometimes that ended the discussion, and sometimes it didn't. When it didn't, she'd harangue me with all the criticisms usually thrown at Bukowski, like a non-smoker preaching the evils of secondhand smoke. And I, like a smoker praising the joys of tobacco, tried to explain what it was like when I saw him read at my first poetry reading in a small bar in Long Beach in the mid-1970s. I tried to explain what it was like seeing an old white guy as tough and cool as the old black bluesman I'd grown up seeing. How the bar was so crowded that all I could see above the drunks and hecklers, the English professors and the students, and all the young men pretending they'd seen and done all that old men had, was his head. His face scarred and unshaven, hair greasy and combed back, the kind of face you used to see on the old men in the old bars on the old streets like Western, Atlantic, and Vermont. I tried to explain what it was like seeing a man who, at a time when rock and roll meant nothing and everyone said, have a nice day, understood the silent madness of an empty room. A man who understood men like my father, men who passed out drunk at kitchen tables or on bathroom floors, who spit out chunks of their lungs while fumbling for another cigarette, men who felt so much they prayed to feel nothing. But I tried hardest to explain to her how I left the bar that night with words pounding in my skull for the first time like a good rock and roll song. His words, words like nothing I'd been taught in school, but it felt every day of my life. And I tried to tell her how from then on I wanted to write poems, songs, anything, and how like the old blues man gave me music, Bukowski gave me words. I never burned my Bukowski books, and I haven't seen the woman I lived with in years. I guess I really didn't love her.
I like that poem.
Thanks.
And I'm wondering if you think singing has helped you read your poems.
No, it's probably hurt. I probably read better before I sang.
You think so?
Yeah, because before I used to actually enjoy poetry readings a lot before I started singing because it was my only outlet that I could, you know, it was the only way I could get my words out through my voice. Because in the Blasters or the time I was in X, you know, my brother Phil was doing all the vocals, or John and Xene, and so I loved to do poetry readings back then because it was more like, okay, it's my turn now, you know. And now my rhythm is more of a singer's rhythm than a poet's rhythm, and as far as reading, if I was to spend maybe a year practicing, I might get pretty good at it. I don't know, but yeah. Maybe with the next book.
You know, I sometimes think that even if I fancied myself a writer, and even if I could write really well, that I might not have the taste to write anything truly autobiographical, because I'd be so self-conscious about not only revealing my own secrets, but the secrets of the people who I've known well and would be writing about. And I wonder if that's been hard for you, like the work you read for us today. The woman you referred to is a real person. I mean, is it hard for you to write about her in that way?
Well, in some ways, yeah, it is, but it's almost... because they're short poems, you almost cartoon it, if you know what I mean. She's actually a really great person from a great family. It's just that we shouldn't have been together, and what I just said doesn't make for a good poem. You know what I mean?
I know exactly what you mean. Yeah.
So, knowing that, and usually when I write poems, is very late at night, and when my sensors are down, and so I try not to think about it. Usually, my experience has been that when I've written a song about someone and they can figure it out, or even when I've written poems about them, even if it's, you know, not derogatory but honest, they tend to laugh or get, you know, feel complimented, you know. And I don't think, you know, I mean, if you read the whole book, I don't think I come off sounding like, you know, a Catholic priest in this book either, so it's not like I'm getting off scot-free. A Catholic priest handing out lyrics to Aqualung.
Well, I'd really like to go out with one of your recent records. Do you want to choose a track that maybe something you've been performing in concert on your tour?
From one of the recent records?
Yeah.
Yeah, probably the closest that I've come to kind of getting the poetry voice, my poetry voice into a song, would probably be a song called $30 Room from an album called Museum of Heart, if you got that.
Well, great. Thank you very much for talking with us.
All right.
Good luck with your poems and, of course, your music.
Thank you, Terry.
Dave Alvin's new book of poems, Any Rough Times Are Now Behind You, is published by Incommunicado Press. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Next to the airport, I can hear them dead. Through the night, some people leaving, some people coming home. There's a sign on the door, says checkout's 11 and a woman's eerie. Laying on the table, she said she'd be back, but I get the feeling she's gone. So I tell myself, one way or another, if she don't,
major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations, and by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, Poetry Slams. We talk with Bill Adler and Bob Holman about their new CD, a companion to the PBS series The United States of Poetry. Also, we meet the reporter who broke the Tailhook story. His new book is a larger investigation into the Navy. Thank you. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Yesterday in Okinawa, three American servicemen, two from the Navy, one from the Marines, were convicted by a Japanese court of abducting and raping a 12-year-old Japanese girl last September. After the rape, demonstrators poured into the streets to protest against the U.S. presence in Okinawa. One admiral lost his job after telling reporters that the servicemen should have hired a prostitute instead. This incident hit the Navy especially hard, coming on the heels of Tailhook. My guest Gregory Vistica broke the Tailhook story in 1991 when he was a reporter with the San Diego Union-Tribune. He was the first to report on the sexual abuse of naval women at the Tailhook Convention. Now he's written a book about Tailhook and other scandals within the Navy pertaining to sexual harassment, spending, and corruption. Vistica's new book is called Fall from Glory, The Men Who Sank the U.S. Navy. I asked him how he got the first information about Tailhook.
I was having lunch with a Navy commander, and we were sitting across the bay from an aircraft carrier, and he said something bad happened to Tailhook this year. I don't know much about it, but it had something to do with a gauntlet and several women being forced to walk through it. And the gauntlet, as we know, was a hallway at the Las Vegas Hilton where women were sexually assaulted when they were forced to walk down it. It was Friday afternoon, and at the time I was working for a newspaper called the San Diego Union-Tribune, big Navy town, conservative newspaper, which is a whole other story how that thing finally got out. And I went back on Friday and I started hitting the phones, and by the end of the day I had enough information to know that something indeed had gone bad. The paper wanted to hold it over the weekend to do more work on it. Monday I got a letter from the president of the Tailhook Association, Captain Fred Ludwig, outlining the gauntlet and showing that five women had been sexually assaulted.
How did you get that letter?
I had built up a large source network within the military. I've been covering the military for quite a number of years. And I knew who had it. After a couple calls, I found the guy who had it, and he agreed to give it to me. So I actually drove on to Miramar Naval Air Station, home to Top Gun, to get the letter. And I was sitting in this office reading this thing, and I was just thinking, my gosh, this is a smoking gun if I've ever seen it. Here's a Navy captain outlining sexual abuse of women, drunkenness, misuse of funds, you name it, and it's in black and white. There's no way the Navy is going to be able to deny it. I came back Monday, wrote the story, called the Secretary of the Navy, asked for a comment, faxed him the letter, and the next day they began all of their big investigations.
The letter that you got, who was that letter intended for?
That letter was intended for the skippers, the squadron commanders. In the Navy, there's several squadrons, and each squadron has a commanding officer. And Fred Ludwig, who was the head of Tailhook, a Navy captain, wrote the letter directed to them, telling them basically, knock this off. You know, we can't tolerate this kind of stuff. But in doing so, he listed all of the problems that had happened, that had occurred at Tailhook. And for what he did, for what he thought he was doing was right, the Navy tried to court-martial him and hold him accountable for all of the sins of Tailhook that year. Yet, there was 33 admirals there, and nothing happened to them. And Fred Ludwig went through some very emotional turmoil as a result of that, and he is now out of the Navy.
What did he say in that letter?
First off, he said this was the mother of all hooks, and it was a great hook, as they called Tailhook. The Secretary of the Navy was there. He enjoyed himself. The Chief of Naval Operations enjoyed himself. You know, it was a successful reunion of Navy pilots after the Persian Gulf War, etc. However, I do have some bad news to report, and he went in and talked about the gauntlet, about sexual abuse of women, including a young teenage girl that had been pushed down the gauntlet and thrown into the corner after she was after she had gone through this. She had been stripped naked, as a matter of fact, and just thrown into the corner. Some pretty incredible stuff like that was in the letter.
Did they ever try to deny it?
They never. That's a very good question. They never really denied it outright, but they would always put their spin on it as, oh, those women knew what they were getting into. they should have never gone up there on the third floor. And, oh, the admirals just didn't have a clue what was going on. And the secretary, although he had been there 2 years in a row in 1990 and 1991, he didn't know what was going on. Those types of efforts to downplay it and to put the Navy spin on it. And quite frankly, all I had to do was sit back almost every other day and watch the Navy step on their foot and make some misstatement in their effort to try to spin it and put there and cover it up. And I just kept getting story after story, and I ended up writing nearly 150 stories on it.
Now, that naval commander who you first had lunch with, who first informed you that there was sexual misconduct at Tailhook, did he have any idea of the magnitude of the story he was giving you?
It's interesting because I just spoke with him the other day. He's still shaking his head today, wondering if he had done the right thing. He didn't understand the magnitude. I don't think I understood the magnitude that this was going to have wholesale impact, not just on the Navy, but on all of the services. And indeed, it's touched into the civilian world as well. I wonder, and I sometimes wonder, if he would have, if he knew that, if he would have not passed that stuff on to me.
Well, do you think that he thinks that the impact that it had on the Navy was bad?
I think he thinks it was both bad and good.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it has torn the Navy apart. In any big historical change in an organization, you're going to get the good caught up with the bad. I mean, look at the Inquisition, for example. I mean, that's happening in the Navy today. There's a lot of innocent people that are being dismissed because they had the Tailhook mark on their records, even though they didn't do anything wrong. They just happened to be at the convention for some reason, and they can't be promoted. Then they're forced into retirement.
But on the good side, you think that breaking the story helped reform the Navy?
Very much so. The Navy public affairs people will tell you that the Navy only changes when they're exposed doing something wrong. This was a monumental watershed event, and it's had tremendous impact for the better for women. The Navy promised to promote more women to admirals. They're trying to sensitize males toward women. They're making fairly honest efforts to eradicate sexual harassment and demeaning attitudes toward women. I dare say, though, they've got a very uphill battle still ahead of them.
How much has the leadership changed?
I think, indeed, they have changed for the better. The civilian leadership, John Dalton, says he will not tolerate sins of moral turpitude. And so far, he's standing firm on that. I don't think the admirals have changed at all. They're still very political. They're still more concerned with their careers. As a matter of fact, I did a Pentagon book signing a couple of weeks ago at the Pentagon, and a former Naval Investigative Service guy came by, and we got on the subject about what's wrong with the admirals. Why are they so political? And he says they take an oath to the Navy and not to the nation. They're going to defend the Navy at all costs. And if you go back and look at all of the scandals that the Navy has been involved in each one, the Navy circles the wagons, they wrap themselves in the flag, and they do whatever they can to protect the Navy. And that includes lying, misleading the public, putting out the wrong story, you name it. And eventually it catches up with them.
When you were first investigating the Tailhook story, you tried to get women who were there and who were victimized to talk with you. What was it like in those early days to try to get women to go on the record and tell you what happened?
Well, one person in particular who I had a long chat with on the first night was Paula Coughlin, who became probably one of the most celebrated victims of Tailhook. She, in the beginning, was very nervous about it. And she started, we had several conversations before I even broke the first story. And she started warming up to the idea about talking with me. And we set some ground rules and all. And I called her the Admiral's aide, which was quickly picked up in the mainstream press. And I'd also talked with other women. And most the women officers who I was able to get a hold of were scared to death. They didn't want their names out because they feared for their careers. And eventually, after many, interviews and coaxing them, And I think I had built up a reputation by my stories of fairness and objectivity, and people started coming forward, including more women, to talk with me.
You broke the Tailhook story for a newspaper in San Diego, and San Diego is a large military town. There's a lot of there's a big Navy base there. And you described the newspaper that you were writing for as a conservative newspaper. Was the newspaper reluctant to go with the story?
I don't say much about that, but they were reluctant to go with the story. It ran, when I broke the Tailhook story, it didn't run on page one. It ran inside the newspaper. And here you had this major event taking place where the Secretary of the Navy was at this convention, the Chief of Naval Operations was at this convention. You had officers and gentlemen, Top Gun flyers, the end of the Persian Gulf War, and you had sexual assaults of women in a so-called gauntlet. It's a pretty important story. And it ran inside the paper. It was very frustrating. And it was an uphill battle trying to continue to cover the story at the paper.
Do you have any more or less faith in the ability of a large institution to change?
If we just focus on the Navy, I don't have much faith that they're really going to change. As much as they say they're going to improve things, quite frankly, I think a lot of it is lip service, because you see this trend continue. Demeaning attitudes toward women, you know, officers getting off for certain crimes.
Have you ever been in the service yourself?
No, actually, I was the last draft of the Vietnam War in 1972. My lottery number was number 6, and I was ready to go. Not willing, I wasn't excited about going in, but unfortunately, we were reclassified eligible till we were 26 years old. But I come from a Navy family.
You come from a Navy family?
Right. And we would sit around the dining room table. I mean, I've got Academy graduates, fighter pilots, a doctor. Most of them are out now. But we would sit around the table and have these discussions about what's wrong with the Navy. And I kept hearing horror stories and horror stories over and over and over again. And that was another reason why I decided to get into the book. I basically come from a blue-collar family, working-class family. You know, we're the little guys, and you always see the big guys getting off. And so I wanted to write a book for the junior-level officers and to show, you know, the troubles and travails that they face.
Well, Greg Vistica, thank you very much for talking with us.
Oh, thank you so much. Appreciate it.
Gregory Vistica's new book is called Fall from Glory, The Men Who Sank the U.S. Navy. He's now the Washington correspondent for Newsweek. This is Fresh Air. My guests Bob Holman and Bill Adler have been presenting poetry in coffee houses, as well as venues you might have assumed were inhospitable, like rock clubs, rock concerts, and MTV. Bob Holman is the co-director and poetry slam host at the New Eurekans Poets Cafe, New York's best-known venue for this new breed of performance poetry. Holman and Bill Adler were two of the co-founders of New Yo Records, which specialized in performance poetry. Adler is a former hip-hop promoter. Now they've teamed up on a new record label called Mouth Almighty. Their first release, The United States of Poetry, is a companion to the public television series of the same name. Most of the poets read with musical accompaniment. Before we meet Bob Holman and Bill Adler, here's a performance from their new CD by Los Angeles poet Ruth Forman, who won the Barnard Poetry Prize in 1993 for her book We Are the Young Musicians. The poem is called Stoplight Politics.
Check out Sister on the corner. Barbecue Fritos, Fanta soda, Dookie braids, knee-high boots, Raiders jacket, talking shit. she embarrass you, huh? Go ahead, sister, roll on by. You rolling somewhere. You gonna conquer the nation world in your hand with your education. You better than sister on the corner. Thank God you never did hang with the brothers going nowhere, talking shit, waiting for the light to turn green. Go ahead, turn your head, look straight ahead and roll that Lexus home to your 50G man, 300G crib. Pray for the light to turn green before you look back over one more time and realize you both the same thing, hoping on the same thing. You just got a car.
Bill Adler, Bob Holman, welcome to Fresh Air. Would it be fair to say that you're trying to bring together the music worlds and poetry?
You know what, I think it'd be fair to say that we want to move poetry from the, dusty bookshelves and these little dark, cavernous clubs onto the main stage of popular culture. That's what we're trying to do.
Well, I got to say that when I first met Bill, it was when he brought Michael Franti, a poet, rapper, who is in the United States of Poetry, down to the Eureka Poets Cafe. And all of a sudden, Michael realized that the poets there were his peers. And he got up and kicked a poem to us. He was rehearsing a rap to him. That was when the idea of bringing rap and poetry, which actually, to me, are two sides of the same coin, into the same room together. And Bill and I started putting together a series called Rap Meets Poetry at that point.
What was that series like? How effective was it? How well did the two worlds get along?
Well, you know, it was funny, and this is something that I learned from Bob, and I learned not to be scared of the kind of clash of sensibilities that obtained there sometimes. And just to enjoy the chaos and the conflict, you know. Poets, by and large, are fairly PC, and the rappers are not. And the rappers tend just to be able to, they're very carefree, and they say what they want to say, and they'd never encountered criticism before, certainly not from people in a small room who would jump up in the middle of a poem and start haranguing them for their sexism and whatnot. And, as I said, when that first began to happen, it made me nervous, and Bob was just thrilled with it. So I'll say this, though. I mean, that was, you know, the relative exception. You know, mostly we had a lot of harmony there and a lot of mutual respect and a lot of mutual learning of one camp from the other.
Bob, why were you thrilled by that clash?
Well, you know, I had, when I first heard rap, I was so thrilled. To me, people were dancing to poetry. But it was a long time. When I talked with KRS-One in 1985, I even handed over the Rhymester of the Year award to him for managing to put together the words granola and Ayatollah. But when I called him a poet, he said, don't speak those words to me. They mean economic death. It took me a while to be able to accept the fact that two live crew also were writing poems. I mean, what is a rap but a densely rhymed, rhythmic collaboration of word and sound? If that's not the definition of a poem, then I'd just like to know what your definition would be. It was from the rappers that the poets learned that it's okay for your words to go beyond the walls of this room. It was from the poets that the rappers learned that those words had better be carefully hewn because they have a lot of impact.
Let's hear another poet that's included in your PBS series and new CD, United States of Poetry. And this is Matt Cook. Tell us something about him and why you included him.
Hey, Matt Cook is the founder of the Milwaukee School of Poetry. He's a young man with a big mouth and a great big mind. I actually ran into him, first of all, at the National Poetry Slam in Boston a few years ago. He and his brother and good friend Sean McNally came. They were the Milwaukee Slam team, and they brought to Slam the mock gladiatorial poetry as blood sport, a sense of anarchy and whimsy that sort of cut right through a lot of the identity politics and rant that you often find at such a slam.
Okay, and this poem is called James Joyce.
James Joyce, he was stupid. He didn't know as much as me. I'd rather throw dead batteries at cows than read him. Everything was going fine until he came along. He started the Civil War. He tried to get the French involved, but they wouldn't listen. They filled him up with desserts. He talked about all the great boxers that came from Ireland, like he trained them or something. Then he started reading some of his stuff. Right as we told him to get lost, he brought up the potato famine. We said, your potatoes are plenty good. Deal with it. Work it out somehow. Then he said, America must adopt the metric system. It's much more logical. We said, no, we like our rulers. Go away. Thomas Jefferson said, you always get the rulers you deserve.
Matt Cook reading his poem James Joyce, as featured on the new CD, The United States of Poetry. We'll be back with Bob Holman and Bill Adler after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guests are Bob Holman and Bill Adler, co-founders of the new record label, Mouth Almighty. You've run a lot of poetry slams. What would you say is the difference between a slam and a reading?
Well, a poetry slam allows you to go to a poetry reading without having to admit that you're going to a poetry reading.
Is that important?
That's very important, you know, because poetry readings generally call up the vision of a poet whose beard twines around the music stand so hard that the words become locked into that beard. A poetry slam should have a variety of poetries there so that you can begin to tune up your ears. And that's the purpose of it.
So what has surprised you both about the reactions that you've gotten to poems and to poets over the years that you've been doing this?
Nothing. Nothing surprised me. You know, why I decided to work with Bob and why is because, you know, when I'd go to the New Eureka Poets Cafe and I'd see the slams and you know, the more kind of conventional readings, it was just, you know, the appeal of these poets and the charisma was so obvious and the response was so free from the audience. You know, it didn't seem abstruse to me. It was just, you know, as I said, I could think of it in terms other than poetry. You know, I said, well, this is rock and roll, or this is rap, or this communicates. You know, what we found walking the corridors of corporate power, you know, within, you know, now that we've got a record deal, is that everybody, actually this is kind of surprising, is that, you know, virtually everybody is kind of a secret poetry lover, and they've never been able to do anything about it, you know, professionally, but, you know, almost, you know, everybody's, you know, father, sister, brother, lover is a poet. And, you know, now all of a sudden they can take their love of this form out of the closet and work to help us, you know, bring it to a wider public.
Well, I want to close with one more poem from United States of Poetry. And this is a poem by Pearl Clegg, and it's called Turning 40. And tell us something about why you chose her and this poem.
Pearl is, to my mind, the poet laureate of Atlanta. we were doing the shows in the United States of Poetry are thematically based, and we were looking for love poems that weren't your standard love poem. And here's a celebration of a hot time remembered when you're a little past the hot times.
It was that summer. That summer we were making love so much, the room smelled obscene. A rich, loamy, tropical smell, right in the middle of the urban jungle. That summer when changing the towels daily made no impact whatsoever. When the washcloths were always too damp to drop into the hamper, and all the incense in the world couldn't save us. Maybe it's the plants, I suggest one day, resting against his arm, trying to blame the withering areca palms, sitting neglected and unwatered in the corner by the Alabama steamer trunk. I don't think so, he says. I think it's you. Me too, I say. Thank God for 40. Me too. It was that summer. It was that summer.
Pearl Clegg is recorded on the new CD, The United States of Poetry. It's the first release from the new record label Mouth Almighty. We heard from two of the co-founders, Bob Holman and Bill Adler. There's also a companion book called The United States of Poetry. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Our program was produced today by Fred Landerl. Technical direction from Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Nate Hardy is our intern. Alan Tu directed the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Harmony Books, publisher of Deepak Chopra's The Way of the Wizard, 20 Ways for Living a Magical Life. This is NPR, National Public Radio.